All right, so introducing David Hume is the title today. I have 3 points to my outline. Number one, we're going to look at what is philosophy according to David Hume after we do a little brief biographical stuff. What is his view of philosophy? Secondly, where does Hume pick up from Locke in the question of where do ideas come from? And then thirdly, we're going to deal with his attempt to overcome the difficulties of empiricism. So that's something about Hume. He starts off as an empiricist. He's classified as an empiricist. But to look at the writings of Hume is to look at the devolution of empiricism. Because in his own career as a philosopher, you start to see, really, David Hume, in all of his writings, lives out the realization of an empiricist that empiricism won't work. And that makes up his skepticism. So I have on the board these four dimensions of Hume's thought. Yes, he was utterly confused, but you will see a synergy between these four ideas. Hume was an empiricist, a naturalist, a conservative, and a skeptic, which doesn't mean he was utterly confused. He was, but there is a connection between these things that I'm going to show you. In his mind, that does not to say that one cannot have a conservatism with regard to history and politics that is not informed by better things than David Hume's was. But you'll see a synergy. Hume, his dates are 711 to 1776. The way he can be classified as all these four things is in the following way. He was an empiricist in what he would call moral philosophy, but let's just call it epistemology. In other words, he's going to pick up where Locke left off. He's an empiricist in epistemology. He's a naturalist when it comes to higher metaphysical philosophy, except that's going to create an immediate problem because his naturalism attacks the idea of metaphysics. He's a conservative in politics, and he's a skeptic in religion. Now, I guess in after his day, much like Voltaire, he's more famous to the man on the street for being a skeptic, for being an enemy of Christianity. And so now we're going to run into the first giant philosopher who's an open opponent of Christianity. You couldn't really make it in the philosophy business by being an explicit opponent of Christianity. Voltaire, who is in his day, wasn't necessarily a trained philosopher. Spinoza was, but Spinoza didn't make it very well in his day. He was only dragged out. His corpse was dragged out posthumously by later admirers, but you couldn't really make it in philosophy before this time by being an open critic of Christianity, because philosophers were better philosophers before this time. Hume was born and raised and studied and died all in Edinburgh, Scotland. And if you are a Scottish listener to our podcasts, I would apologize to you, but you probably know already that David Hume is a massive embarrassment to you. In fact, if you go to Edinburgh, you will be, what is it called? I always get them confused, not St. Giles. I always get the one in Scotland and the one in Switzerland confused. But anyway, the main church that John Knox preached in, if you were to go to it today in the downtown area, you will go to, you'll first of all see in the city square a statue of David Hume. A large statue of David Hume, almost a godlike statue of David Hume. But if you go behind the church in the parking lot, underneath parking lot 23, if there's no car parked there, you'll notice the number 23, which conveniently is next to 22 and so on and so forth. Underneath that lot is the body of John Knox. That's where he's buried. So that will give you an idea of how the mighty have fallen in Scotland. So if you are Scottish, I am sorry, but it's not new to you. That's pretty much how things have gone. Well, anyway, that's David Hume, the great embarrassment of the Scottish people everywhere. But the university system at the time wouldn't really have David Hume. But in spite of that, he's considered the greatest of the English-speaking philosophers by skeptics after that time. He spent some time in France in his mid-20s, where he published A Treatise of Human Nature in 1738, which he later said it fell dead-born off the press. Nobody read it. It's about that thick, and it's pretty obscure. It was too abstract, too cumbersome for the general population to read. So he went back to the drawing board, And he wrote some more books, an essay on moral and political, or essays moral and political in 1744. He attracted some academic attention, and so finally he wanted to get to teach at the university in Edinburgh. And it was denied to him because the local clergy petitioned the faculty of the university on the grounds that Hume was a skeptic, so he didn't get the job. Well, finally he made his real mark, his book that we're going to be quoting from the majority of the time in 1748, called his Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. So not too different from the title of Locke's book, the Essay Concerning Human Understanding. They weren't too original. But this is small. What it is, it's a pared-down version of his original book that nobody read, and he just retained all the what he thought were was the best stuff from it. And it's such a it's a much smaller book. It's an easier read today. And generally, if you go to study philosophy in college today, that's one of the 10 books that you will have to read, Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. He wrote some ethical books. He actually wrote A History of England in 1761, which took 7 years and over 1 million words. It was widely acclaimed as the official history at that time. And he took the reader from the invasion of Julius Caesar all the way to the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Now, his extreme antipathy toward the Christian religion shows up in a book in 1757, The Natural History of Religion. It proposes a naturalistic account of the evolution of religious beliefs. So long before Darwin and long before Julian Wellhausen and a 19th century history of religion school, these ideas were not new. David Hume gives you a, well, first people started with animism. They were afraid of thunder. They worshipped their rock just to hide from the thunder. And then they started worshiping their goats because they were softer. And then, you know, you get the idea, one to two to three to persons to forces of nature. And that's kind of the way it went. And David Hume wrote something like that. Well, it was the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. It was released in 1779. That was published posthumously because it was even more just in your face, Christianity's evil. You know, he graduated to Voltaire-level hatred to Christianity. So that was published after his death. And we'll quote from that too. So those are the two books we'll quote from, The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, and then in a few weeks, maybe the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, where he famously takes on miracles so as to attack the idea of the resurrection. Anyway, what is philosophy according to David Hume? Well, in this book, he comes right out of the chute defining philosophy as moral philosophy, which is interesting to begin with, moral philosophy. And he subdivides that moral philosophy into two sections, man as an actor and man as an intellect. So he looks at philosophy and he sees different philosophers focus on, one group of philosophers focuses on principles of action toward the end of making men better. The others focus on the principles of understanding toward the end of making him brighter. Now Hume seems to think that the only lasting philosophy is that which allies itself with common sense. And so that's why, he says, Cicero is still being read today, while Aristotle was coming to his second death after a brief uprising at the end of the Middle Ages. Now, as I read that, I wonder how selectively Hume had read Cicero, because Cicero did talk about eternal things, like the eternal law. But at any rate, here we can see a first idea that shows up in Hume's philosophy. And you'll see this show up really everywhere. There is a preference in David Hume's philosophy for, I'm going to introduce two Latin phrases. We talk about them all the time, but if you don't know what these are yet, a posteriori, and I'm going to put that on the bottom of the board, and a priori, I'm going to put that on the top of the board. And literally, they just mean from before and from afterwards, but the focus in these phrases in the Latin, when they're brought up in philosophical textbooks or theology textbooks, is experience. So in between a priori and a posteriori is the word experience. And so when they're used, they typically mean truth arrived at before experience, truth arrived at after experience. This is going to feature prominently in Hume's philosophy. And it's going to be what makes him a conservative. And by the way, be careful. I don't have this in my notes, but beware. As you read conservative authors, authors who I like, most extreme in Oliver Wendell Holmes in the 19th century, so a clear evolutionary naturalist applying his naturalism to legal theory, But even later on, in conservative giants like Russell Kirk and Thomas Sowell, who are much more explicitly Christian, they're Roman Catholic, they're genuine, they have good ideas, but there is this kind of conservatism that would also not just claim Edmund Burke for themselves, but even David Hume. Because there is a focus, as opposed to liberalism, which tries to impose the ideas of the few, the madman, the innovator, on the rest of society. Conservatism takes the wisdom of the laws and customs of a people over time. So that will give you a little bit of a hint as to what's the connection between Hume's ideas in his epistemology and his political conservatism. There's just an early hint right there. So that's huge in Hume's thought. A posteriori reasoning over a priori reasoning. Whether the subject is science or religion or politics, wisdom is to be found in the experience of the many and never in the supposed insight of the lone wild genius. Except for Hume. Here's what he says about that. He says, but this obscurity, now why is he going to bring this up in the realm of philosophy this quickly? Because he's going to take a stab at metaphysicians. The same way we would look at social innovators, Hume is going to look at medieval scholastics in the same way. He says, but this obscurity in the profound and abstract philosophy is objected to not only as painful and fatiguing, but as the inevitable source of uncertainty and error. So right there, Hume has two strikes against traditional philosophy, metaphysics. Not only is it obscure, but it tends to uncertainty and error. In other words, it gives Hume a headache. That's my insertion. Here indeed lies the justest and most plausible objection against a considerable part of metaphysics. By the way, watch serpentine thinkers. The earlier their writings, the more they couch things. A considerable part of metaphysics. But as you read on, he means all metaphysics. He's understating his case to warm up his audience. Herein lies the justest and most plausible objection against a considerable part of metaphysics, that they are not properly a science, but arise either from, he's going to charge two motives, bad motives, to metaphysics and anybody who really studies traditional philosophy. Metaphysics arise either from the fruitless efforts of human vanity, which would penetrate into subjects utterly inaccessible to the understanding, or from the craft of popular superstitions, which, being unable to defend themselves on fair ground, raise these entangling brambles to cover and protest their weakness. So Hume still lived in the day in which he had to say about Aquinas, that's hard, that's tangled, that's a lot of words to say much ado about nothing. But he at least had to say that's very highly sophisticated, it's a bunch of sophisticated nonsense, because these monks had nothing better to do than to weave these logic exercises. Nowadays you don't even have to say that, because nobody recognizes what medieval people are saying as profound or anything of the sort. But his first false motive is very, very interesting. Metaphysics arises, these tangled arguments arise, because of fruitless efforts of human vanity. So let me retranslate those two bad motives. Metaphysics, traditional philosophy, talking about being as if you could know what it was, is a result of two things. Either people who think too highly of their brains, which could be Christians or non-Christians, or the church sending out its priestly class, the smartest among them, to distract you, a giant intellectual and verbal shell game, to distract you from the obvious fact that where's this God? I can't see him. So the claim is this. In stabbing philosophy right through, he hits theology in the heart, and he means to. Here's his claim. Metaphysics was the invention of the sharpest tongues among the priestly class, and it accomplished what all of their ancient witchcraft could no longer accomplish. The tangled catechisms, the Latin words and phrases, the syllogisms, and the extended proofs, all a desperately constructed last-ditch moat around the surrounded castle of supernaturally revealed religion. But of course, all the phrases that Hume borrows from to say that, to deconstruct metaphysics, uncertainty and error, a science, subjects utterly inaccessible to the understanding. All of those phrases that Hume borrows from in that deconstruction represent metaphysical objects, so that he has to borrow the scholastics' magic shovel to dig their grave. I remember I was talking to somebody at Barnes & Noble one time that I was working with, and he said, yeah, philosophy, that's, how did he say it? That's fruitless exercises in insoluble puzzles. And I said, well, you seem to have solved some things right there. You've decided, you've come to the conclusion, you've been able to state in 30 seconds or less that nothing can be known. Well, that's what you mean by those words. And so we just sort of parrot and repeat these empty phrases. And that's what Hume's doing right here. But beyond that, he's positioning the metaphysics of the scholastics, traditional philosophers, as a bunch of obscurantist cowards, hiding behind all their words to distract you from real substance. Well, no one has excelled the Enlightenment authors in cowardly obscurity. It only takes later generations to point out the subtle skepticism in their early writings. Why doesn't Hume come out and say it? Why doesn't he declare his full thoughts on Christianity and Western civilization in his first writings? It's because he is like a parasite who needs a host. He undermines as much of the foundation as he can while still maintaining enough of it for his soapbox. Just like every professor who ever had a job in any university in the West in the last 150 years. Machen brings this up in Christianity and Liberalism too. This is cowardice. And I honestly, when I first became a Christian, I was actually sketching out an idea for a book called Perverts of the Intellect. And I was the idea, the thesis, I was drawing the parallel between college professors and sexual predators. Because all of the motives, all of the methods, all of the ends, everything about it is directly parallel. These are intellectual cowards, and yet Hume is saying the exact thing about his opponents. History will judge the real obscurantists as those who couldn't afford to say what they really thought when they were still around to say it. And yet Hume has to accept the empirical lingo on faith. Unlike talk of spiritual things, Hume says, when it comes to things natural, he says there cannot remain any suspicion that this science is uncertain and chimerical. So he's talking about real science, naturalistic stuff. That's all he can say right now is science about stuff. There can't remain any, unlike philosophy, there can't remain any suspicion about the certainty of this science, unless we should entertain such a skepticism as is entirely subversive to all speculation and even action. In other words, I'm a skeptic, but not so much. I can't be skeptical of science. Why? For a practical reason. We need to do science, and we need to do things. So watch that in the Enlightenment. I have no real foundation to believe what I believe anymore. But for the sake of science and ethics, those are the two dreams of the Enlightenment. I want to know my world, and I want to make sure we don't kill each other in the process, or at least kill the right people. Okay, so for science and ethics, we need a foundation still. So we can't entertain suspicion all the way down to the core. He says it cannot be doubted that the mind is endowed with several powers and faculties, that these powers are distinct from each other, that what is really distinct to the immediate perception may be distinguished by reflection, and consequently that there is a truth and falsehood in all propositions on this subject, and a truth and falsehood which lie not beyond the compass of human understanding. So Hume at least believed that Locke and the other empiricists had given the best philosophy of mind on record. He was aware of the criticisms against Locke. He was aware that Locke ended his own book saying, by the way, this makes all of our thoughts only ideas of themselves and not actually of objects outside of our minds. Hume was aware of those criticisms. But he took those criticisms of empiricism not as a dead end sign to turn back, but as a challenge to press further. It's a lot like the awareness that Stephen Jay Gould or other evolutionists had of original Darwinism. And what they do is they say, but since we're here, i.e. since evolution is a fact, and then they proceed from there. The faith is too important to take that as a dead-end signal. It's a challenge to press further. Because at least Locke had moved in the right direction of a natural explanation. I'm going to assume that the right direction is a natural explanation for things. And just as Isaac Newton had charted the whole of the heavens, so Hume says there is no reason to despair of equal success in our inquiries concerning the mental powers and economy. Typical Enlightenment inference. Just like Newton had reduced the whole universe to a system, I can explain the motions of the heavens. In the same way, if I can do that, surely I can explain the motions of this little thing, man. And so there was an expectation in the Enlightenment. I'm going to introduce this picture today to the kids. Schaefer's staircase. Once you get to naturalism right here, in other words, once your philosophy at the level of physical science says that nature is all there is and man is a thing, then man is purely natural. So what do you have at the next step? The humanities, the old humanities, are now turned into the social sciences. If the whole universe is purely molecules in motion and man is in that universe, then man is purely molecules in motion. So you can see how rationalism and empiricism leads directly to naturalism in the physical sciences as a whole. And that then leads to the reconstruction of the study of man in society as the social sciences. Man is reduced to molecules in motion. For Hume, this was an optimistic prospect that we can know. If Newton can know this about that big thing, we can know this about this little thing named man. So where do ideas come from? Now we're going to go right back to John Locke. Hume begins to talk about perception, and here's what he does. So let's remember, we'll come back to this, but let's remember the assembly line of Locke. I can never do a head. Let's put a kilt on him, because he's Scottish. What's one of those beanies in there? I don't know. It's plaid. Anyway, all right, so you get the idea. It's an assembly line, but it's a Scottish assembly line now. But it's the same thing. Where's an eight ideas? They're on the box on the floor. They're not really real. X. You get the idea. It's the whole thing. And so where do ideas come from? Remember, Locke is going to call this perception, namely our awareness of these outside things. And remember, sensation was coming this way. So Locke divided our experience into two things, sensation and reflection. Okay, so you're just going to start with that simple picture. There's not going to be any disagreement there. Hume is going to do something. He's aware of the criticisms. He's aware of the shortcomings. And so he has to do something different. And it's interesting what he does. He starts with the example of heat. I am still recovering from my horrible cold. That's a fire. I can never do that. You get the idea. Okay, and I'm putting number one by that fire. Really, it's in the box because you want him to feel it. But over here, in this cloud, in his mind, I'm going to put same thing. But it's obviously going to represent the idea of a fire. Okay? So number one, number two. I actually should make this bigger because I want to give you the idea of what Hume's really getting at. All right? Bigger fire, number one. Fire in the brain, little fire. Here's why. Okay? He uses the example of heat. He proceeds to contrast our memory of sense perception with the original. Okay? So the idea in our mind is number two. The original is number one. The difference is in the intensity of the impression. Hume is going to pick up where Locke leaves off, but he's going to really focus on the intensity. Hume is going to get intense about the intensity of the impression. And here there's no comparison. The original is much more intense than the memory. We can immediately detect a strategy in Hume's mind to give empiricism a makeover. Clearly, and here's his words, the vivacity of the original sentiment is meant to stand for more real. And the intellectual copy of the external stimulant is more like a faint echo. So here's how he says it, very short and sweet. The most lively thought is still inferior to the dullest sensation. So, underneath big fire number one, let's put more real. Under echo, reflection, memory, what was that again? Fire, sure. Less real. He's going to take Locke to his logical conclusion. Remember, Locke was a Christian. Locke wasn't drawing out empiricism for the sake of metaphysical naturalism. But Hume is going to do that. Okay, so there's a strategy. The most lively thought is still inferior to the dullest sensation. Superiority and inferiority of thought is now being reduced to the liveliness of the impression. But he doesn't just do it out there. Hume is going to give us a second assembly line. It's going to arise from the heart. So let's put a second fire in his heart, and we're going to call that passion. Out here, this was called sensation. In here, it's going to be called passion. So second assembly line also going in, and we'll just leave number two at that destination, that intersection, that both sensation from outside and passion from inside, both, I think, well represented by a fire, they're going to be more real than the idea of them. So likewise with the passions of anger or love, a man is more ready to act upon them who has them than the man who only thinks upon them. So the man in love will be more loving in his action than the man that thinks on love. What is he doing? He's reducing the objectivity of an idea to the usability of the idea. You're more ready to act if you have this fire than if you think about this fire. He reduces objectivity to usability or functionality. But no matter, because Hume has found his crack to drive in the wedge of his empiricist makeover. He divides up perceptions into these two neat categories according to the two different degrees of force and vivacity. That's what I mean by one and two. The less forcible and less lively are commonly denominated thoughts or ideas. So let's put number two in the mind in capital letters. Let's put ideas because it'll be two I words. It'll be better. Thoughts or ideas. So inside the mind at number two, the less lively we'll call ideas. Hume continues, the other species, impressions, by impressions, I mean all our more lively perceptions when we hear or see or feel or love or hate or desire or will. So it is interesting. Let me put out here on this assembly line, we'll put, let's not do that. Let's put in between them both so you can get the idea. Both sensation assembly line and the passion assembly line, this number one is called impressions. So what has he done? He has divided up perception into two things. The more lively impressions, the less lively the reflection of them, ideas. So that's the basic Humean division. It is interesting that he couples passions and sensations together as the prime movers of ideas, whereas Locke, remember, would have only placed sensation. Now, elsewhere, Hume is going to call these inward sentiments passions and outward sentiments. So under passion, under this flame, let's put, oh boy, lower part of the board, inward sentiment. And out here, at sensation, outward sentiment. So sentiment and feeling, i.e. strong feeling, is going to be the origin of ideas. That is interesting for tough-minded Hume. You atheists out there, just understand that your best philosopher puts feeling over thinking, i.e. A feeling is more like an objective thought than a thought. Does that bother you? It should. And so sensation over here, the beginning of the outside assembly line. Passion over here, beginning of the indoor assembly line. Okay? So, where to next? Well, he brings us into the same factory that Locke did. Again, the difference in the assembly line is that while the father of empiricism, John Locke, gave us only one assembly line in, Hume gives us the two, the other one coming up from the heart, in a sense. So, whether via passion or sensation, here's where Hume is going to get inside the factory now, say roughly the same thing John Locke did, because remember, we wanted to ask Locke, okay, in the factory, so what's an idea then? What's an idea, John Locke? And he's going to answer us, well, here's some simple ideas, here's some complex ideas. He starts breaking out the Lego pieces and putting them together, and you're like, no, what is an idea? I didn't ask you how you put the Lego pieces together. I know a unicorn is a horn mixed with a wing, mixed with a horse. I know that. I got that. My daughter knows that. She draws them all the time. I asked you, what is an idea? Okay? And he doesn't answer it. So whether it's via passion or whether it's via sensation, Hume says, all this creative power of the mind amounts to no more than the faculty of compounding, transposing, augmenting, or diminishing the materials afforded us by the senses and experience. So notice that inside the factory, Hume has said pretty much the same thing Locke did. The difference is that there's two lines coming in, pretty much. And the difference is that Hume is really going to accentuate the intensity, the starting point of the impressions. Okay? To prove this, Hume says, this is his direct quote, to prove this, so my antennas are up. I'm reading Hume and I'm like, oh, good. It's about time. Maybe the Scots will be better at this than the English. To prove this, the two following arguments will, I hope, be sufficient. End quote. I hope so too, Mr. Hume. But before we hear Hume's proposed two proofs, let's consider the difficulty of an empirical proof. And right there, your antenna should remember those two square circles that once the factory was done and we opened up the box and it was product inspection time, when the product inspector shows up and he looks in the box, he's going to pull out two square circles, and I can't draw the shape because they're square circles. So the two square circles are empirical objects. We realize that objects by definition are not empirical things, and we showed why, and then empirical ideas. And you could say empirical data too. Same thing is going to... We saw why those are square circles. Well, Hume is going to rescue Locke, and he's going to do so by offering us two empirical proofs. My antennas are still up. I was ready to put them away. Empirical proofs? Is a proof an empirical thing? Okay, but let's hear him. Let's give him a chance. Let's give him a chance and see if he fares any better at proof being an empirical thing than the things that he's trying to resurrect. Now remember, what he's trying to prove. He is proving that all ideas originate in sensation and they're made complex by reflection. So he's going to prove Locke's system by two arguments. Let's hear these two arguments. Quote, first, when we analyze our thoughts or ideas, however compounded or sublime, we always find that they resolve themselves into such simple ideas as were copied from a preceding feeling or sentiment. So stop right there. When we examine this in the box at the end of the assembly line, we always find that when we take the Lego pieces apart, we just get smaller Lego pieces. Okay, for example, here's his example. The idea of God. What a lot of arrogance taking on that as my example. For example, you know, I mean, why not a unicorn? Why not a lemon? But he goes right to the top and says, for example, the idea of God as meaning an infinitely intelligent, wise, and good being arises from reflecting on the operations of our mind and augmenting without limit those qualities of goodness and wisdom. And then he goes on to say in the next sentence, and you won't find any exception to this in any other example you can give, the lemon or the whatever else. Basically, he's saying what Ludwig Feuerbach said in the next century and what Sigmund Freud said at the end of the century. Our idea of God is a projection of stuff we have in this life and in our minds. And we, so I have a father, and I love him, and I need to be loved by him, and so I'm going to father figure. Well, it's an ingenious psychological explanation, but it begs all the questions. It's a different subject altogether. Okay, and so he's saying, whenever we have the Lego pieces all together in any idea that make up any complex idea, we break them apart and we see little pieces, and you won't find any exception. I don't even have to. Did he forget what he was proving? So let's leave that alone for a second. Secondly, his second argument. If it happens from defect of the organ, so now he's going to be aware of Berkeley's criticism of Locke. Somebody has jaundice. Somebody's been in the war, and when they hear noises, they think it's a gunshot, even though it's just a door. Okay, so if it happens from defect of the organ, that a man is not susceptible to any species of sensation. Now, he's going a different direction than Berkeley now. He's going to say, let's imagine Helen Keller. If a man is not susceptible to any species of sensation, we always find, Hume has said that in both proofs so far, we always find, everybody agrees with me. Well, not everybody agrees with me. By we always find, but everybody disagreed with you before your book. Well, by always, I just mean myself. Beware when somebody says, we all know. Well, then shut up. Well, it goes without saying. Well, don't say anything. Okay, so we always find, if there's no sensation coming in, that he is as little susceptible of the corresponding ideas. A blind man can form no notion of colors, a deaf man of sounds. Okay, so those are his two arguments. Those are his two proofs. Well, it's plain that either Hume was hasty in this writing, or else he failed to pay attention in logic class, because these do not even take the form of proof, let alone constitute poor proofs. In the first, Hume is simply regurgitating Locke's corpse and essentially dares his reader to produce an exception to the rule that none of us denies anyway. Three Lego pieces together make a thingy with three. That's not your burden. His burden is to establish the rule, not to assume the rule. And so he's daring his readers to produce an exception to the rule, but he hasn't established what an idea is. He's assuming it. In the second, Hume comes a little bit closer to a valid argument of some sort. It is valid to argue, premise one, the knowledge of a sensation requires the corresponding sense. If I'm going to know what blue is, I need eyes. Premise two, Johnny lacks the sense of sight. Therefore, Johnny must lack the knowledge of visual sensations. Well, that's true. But that is to forget again what the burden of proof is, which was not merely to show that all personal experience of sensation requires senses. Nobody disagrees with that. But whether all ideas could be reduced to these in the first place. In other words, what he's doing is begging the question. And the question is whether all ideas equal all experience of sensation. Remember, Locke gave us a system that explained the origin of all ideas. It is his burden to show us at least what one idea is, since he is reducing all ideas to this Lego construction, from simple ideas to complex ideas. And so Hume is assuming that. He's begging the question. He gives us the counterexample, the counterproof, that a blind man can't tell what color is because he doesn't have sight. So you're assuming up front that our visual stimuli of blue, all ideas are just like that. But that's your burden to prove. You're assuming it. You're begging the question, which is a fallacy. And by the way, it's not going to be the last time that Hume famously commits this fallacy. He's going to do the same on the question of miracles and on the question of induction. Hume's best ideas are all exercises in circular reasoning and question begging. And this is their best philosopher, don't forget that. We get the sense that the idea of impressions, no irony intended yet, the idea of impressions. Hume wants to foist the idea of impressions on us. But of course, No empiricist has yet defined satisfactorily what an idea is without contradiction. But the idea of impressions is going to be more crucial in Hume than it was in Locke. And so in summary, let's define again so we don't forget for Hume what this term means. An impression is a lively perception as opposed to an idea, which is only the faint reflection or faint memory. So impression is boom, fire, ow. Idea is, what was that again? Okay, so the impression is the point of contact between the strong feeling and our thinking about it. But here's the key and here's the irony. The strong feeling, again, is the starting point. The strong feeling can arise from inward sentiment, that's passion, or it can invade from outward sentiment, that's sensation. But the impression that is made is superior to the idea of the impression. Physical stimulation is more like truth than an idea. Is this tough-minded atheism or tough-touch atheism? Is this reason or stimuli? This is the idea at the foundation of our world today. This is tough-minded. Hume has at least taken this aspect of empiricism, namely the supremacy of the material world, to its logical conclusion. So after treating the origin of ideas in part 2 of this book, Hume turns to the association of ideas in part 3. He says there's a principle of connection between our thoughts. So now what he has to do is deal with all the formal categories that he knows deep down inside are more like ideas than the stuff he's talking about. All the stuff those scholastics used to talk about, formal principles. So he has to deal with connection, how our mind connects things. Because as an empiricist, he already told you, our mind connects things like Lego pieces. We just do that, and we make a unicorn out of it. So he has to explain everything like that, even logic. So he says, basically, there has to be a universal principle that holds these Lego pieces together, but Hume is not aware of any philosopher who has ever ruled on the matter, and that's sufficient for him. I'm not, as far as I know, no philosopher has really done this to my satisfaction. Therefore, I'm going to propose in place of this three principles of connection among ideas, namely resemblance, contiguity, and cause and effect. So let me write those down. I'll put them over here. Now, you can make a unicorn out of Lego pieces, but you can't make the laws of logic or even cause and effect out of Lego pieces, but he's going to try. So he gives you three principles of connection. Resemblance, and by this one, contiguity just means time and place. Again, he's got to make them out of the same stuff of the material world, and then cause and effect. So his three principles of connection, and again, he's got to connect them like Lego pieces at the end of the day, but in some way he's got to make these foundational. He describes what he means by all three with simple examples. Quote, a picture naturally leads our thoughts to the original. In other words, resemblance. The mention of one apartment in a building naturally introduces an inquiry or discourse concerning the others. Contiguity. And if we think of a wound, we can scarcely forbear reflecting on the pain which follows it. Cause and effect. So he tells you what he means by that, and he's going to move on from there to deal with logic, which I'm going to deal with in just a second, but I'm getting that on the board. This last section, he is going to try to overcome some of the famous difficulties of empiricism. He considers Berkeley's objection concerning color. And in a sense, he says, forget about defects in the senses. Let's use something more common. Simply consider that different colors and different shades of colors strike different eyes, conceivably as utterly unique every single time. Well, Hume has to overcome this. Berkeley's saying perspective and defect make sure that everything that comes in makes the idea of empirical ideas absolutely unintelligible. Because they're never really about the same object at any point, about any predicate or any property. So Hume takes on color. And he thinks that it is sufficient to imagine a single color with a spectrum of many shades. So take blue and pretend you're in the paint store with all those different, you know, the paint colors, trying that out, and you see all those different colors right there. Yeah, so you have, yeah, so what he does is he says, imagine one's missing in the middle, okay? And he says, what's more likely? To imagine whether the man could construct that shade from his own a priori ideas or whether it would be entirely from impressions from outside himself. In other words, he'll look at the other colors on the spectrum and somewhat fill that one in. That's nice, but that ignores the whole point of Berkeley's dispute. It was not whether or not color was trans-color spectrum imposed. In other words, Berkeley wasn't saying that, you see, I can construct color. In fact, all of our color comes from ideas about something other than color. Okay? So that we're constructing it. Rather, Berkeley's point was that there was no substance there. There is no object there in the paint store outside of me that was not reducible to idea. So Hume was not looking deeply enough into the material of the colors, into the light, and saying, okay, what's the object? Is it something that could be constructed from physical stimuli, from particles, or is it, in fact, an intellectual object? Section 4 turns more polemical to defend himself, and here's where he gives us the earliest and most basic form of the distinction that's going to lead to the downfall of his own system. I'm going to end here, but this is important, because Hume is so busy defending empiricism that he winds up introducing a problem to his own system. It's going to become a famous one. He's going to make a distinction between two different legitimate kinds of truth. Here's how he says it. All the objects of human reason or inquiry may naturally be divided into two kinds, to wit, relations of ideas, in other words, logic and mathematics, and matters of fact, in other words, his favorite stuff, science as he conceives it, science. Of the first kind are the sciences of geometry, algebra, and arithmetic, and in short, every affirmation which is either intuitively or demonstratively certain. Secondly, matters of fact, which are the second objects of human reason, are not ascertained in the same manner, nor is our evidence of their truth, however great, of a like nature with the foregoing. The contrary of every matter of fact is still possible, because it can never imply a contradiction. So there's two juicy things there. Let's treat them in their turn. First of all, Hume acknowledges that the truths of mathematics and logic are necessary and certain. But then he denies to them real being. Notice he called the second class matters of fact. Mathematics and logic are about necessary relations, not things. He doesn't want to say things. Why doesn't he want to say things? He's an atheist. He's a naturalist. He can't admit that for and necessity and cause and effect are things. He can't admit that universal things are things. So he calls the second matters of fact. Now, logic and mathematics are necessary in some way, but not necessary things. So he's realistic about the truths of nature, that they cannot attain that same level of certainty as logic and mathematics, only probability, but they are at least of real things. What is he doing? He's begging the question again. That's the formula that survived the Enlightenment, particularly in Anglo-American philosophy. But at this point, his rationale for it is more interesting than his division. He says at the end, in the last sentence, the contrary of every matter of fact is still possible, because it can never imply a contradiction. And then he adds, for example, that the sun will not rise tomorrow is no less intelligible a proposition and implies no more contradiction than the affirmation that it will rise. So, in logic, and the bottom of the square of opposition, those two bottom ones are the particular ones, the type I and the type O statement. And so what you have, in particular things, let's ignore the universal side of it, because those aren't real things. These are particular, particular affirmative and particular negative. So if I say some X is something, oh boy. And then in the type O statement, that same some X is not something. These imply, or the Non-existence of a particular thing implies no contradiction. Now, this is called a sub-contrary relationship. One of them has to be true. Anytime I say something is something, if I say there are six people in this room, either the truth of that statement or its contrary, one of them has to be true. Now, that's important, and Hume recognizes that. The way an atheist hears that is that the non-existence of any particular thing implies no contradiction. In other words, nothing is necessary. No thing is necessary. This is repeated in logic textbooks everywhere since then. Kant is going to make a whole thing of it. It's called his antinomies when we get to the Critique of Pure Reason. But Hume lays this down already. No particular thing is necessary. That is crucial to the naturalistic system. If they admit any one thing that's necessary, atheism collapses. But if they don't admit anything that's necessary, reason collapses, and so does science. But we'll come back to that. This is a staple of late modern philosophy. Take any particular object or state of affairs. If it is truly a particular, there is nothing about it that must be. The thing's non-existence implies no contradiction. Now, Hume's motive for this cheap magic trick of the mind is clear enough. He's already told his reader that metaphysics is not a real science. If it was to study real being, then the thing that would distinguish metaphysics from physics would be the claim of metaphysics to real, necessary truth about real, particular being. At the end of the day, this is the dragon that Hume must slay. Necessary being. Interesting. I don't know if Hume ever read Edwards, but at the exact time that Hume is writing this nonsense, Edwards is defending necessary being. And it is an interesting contrast. Still waking up. Interesting contrast that at the same time, Edwards is more articulately defending necessary being than anybody else ever, and Hume is more famously attacking the idea of necessary being than anyone up until his time. Even the idea of logic has to fall by this. The idea of contrast, which underlies logic, is not a suitable fourth principle of connection on that list. Rather, we arrive at the complex idea of contradiction by a combination of two of the other more real principles, causation and resemblance. So by principles 1 and 3, we, like Lego pieces, we construct the bigger Lego piece of logic. Two ideas, Hume says, have something in common, resemblance, and then one annihilates the other. That's causation. And so we have the effect of contradiction. Now, interestingly, Hume puts this as a footnote in the book, no doubt out of the trepidation for realizing what a silly, stupid, indefensible idea this is. But nevertheless, logic falls by this. But if logic falls, doesn't Hume's argument fall? Okay, we'll come back to that too. Unfortunately, I don't have time to get, and this is fine, this actually goes better with the next one, but Hume is going to start to needle at the idea of the formal relationship between cause and effect. Now, he is accused in his day, and he is still misunderstood today, to be disbelieving in causality per se, that every effect has a cause. He's going to say, I don't disagree that that is happening. I am questioning our knowledge, our capacity to describe, to discern the power behind any particular cause and effect. In other words, he has to eliminate the necessary connection between any particular cause and any particular effect. Now, what happens to science if you do that? Okay, he's trying to knock out theology. He's trying to knock out the cosmological argument, for example, of Aquinas. He's going to knock out science doing it. So what we're going to start to see is Hume's empiricism begetting deeper skepticism. Skepticism not merely of Christian theology and scholastic metaphysics, but skepticism of science. Okay, so let me end there, and that's where I'll pick up next time. Any questions or comments or tomatoes that you want to throw at Mr. Hume?
There are two more oxymorons in there. You have more real than less real.
Uh-huh. Exactly, exactly.
So, he actually, I was with him, he says that ideas are inferior to the thing in the sense that...
In liveliness of feeling.
Yeah,
in liveliness.
In the strict dictionary sense, inferior, meaning smaller, or doesn't weigh as much, or things like that. But to say less real means it doesn't exist as much.
Yeah, and even where it's more lively, it's very subjective. It's more subjectively real. The feeling of being burnt is more subjectively real than my idea, my memory of being burnt. But you've reduced the whole thing to subjectivity at that point. Hume doesn't even have in his radar screen at this point. That tree is more real than my idea of the tree. Now, he may want to believe that as a tough-minded naturalist, but empiricism hasn't even reached out to the actual tree yet. It's still dealing with ideas in here.
Right, but the idea either exists or it doesn't exist. It's not.
Yeah, and the moment he says that's more real as an object, then he's right back to, he can't be an empiricist. Right.
It's not a nothing.
Right.
It's not a non-existent.
It's not a nothing until constructed by the paint store. According to Hume's beliefs, the very color was created literally and metaphysically by Glidden, or give me a paint company. You know paint. the color was invented. And in a loose sense, when you shake up the paint, of course, they're inventing a color, but not... metaphysically.
Right. You forgot a third option in that paint store, the one where your wife goes, it's
something. Keep going. The wife is actually closer to the idea of God and infinity by being undecided.
Okay.
That's right.
I couldn't make heads or tails, but I just thought I was smart enough to understand what he was talking about.
All right.
The second time I read you, my school teacher was telling me I was totally misunderstanding it.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I understand, it's true, he's not making sense.
Right. He's given Locke a makeover. He's focusing, and he's taking it to its naturalistic, logical conclusion. But what do you hear today? When you hear empirical today, which, by the way, that's not a bad word. We like, same way, rational. Don't let the rationalists define rational for you. Don't let the empiricists define empirical. We like empirical data. Empirical data is a corrective to harebrained anti-economists who want to control people's lives. We like empirical data. But when you think empirical, when you're talking to a naturalist, what is the picture that's presented to you? No, empirical, I'm the one that believes that the tree outside of me is bigger than the impression of the tree inside of me. Actually, you don't know empiricism enough. You actually can't be committed to that. I'm sure, hook you up to lie detector test, I'm sure you're sincere. But that's actually not what empiricism says. Yes, but that they wouldn't, at that point, they wouldn't be considering that an empiricist statement. They would just be mixing their superior liberalism with their empiricism that they apply to other things. So they have this divided universe in their own minds too.
And how do conservatives fail in this? The American political...
I think back to Hume's The A Priori versus The A Posteriori. So read Thomas Sowell's book, The Vision of the Anointed, or any of his books. They're good books, and when he takes the empirical data and he smashes it into the Great Society or whatever else, he has a good point, namely that the fantasy, the vision of the liberal, of the dreamer, of the reformer in the political sense is, for them, they don't want to confuse facts with their fantasy is much more important than the reality of empirical data. And so conservatives at that point can be the great defenders of empirical data and therefore wake him up from his fantasy. On the other hand, guys like Sowell and Kirk and others take that too far to define law and the justice of law by the wisdom of the custom and history of a people. Well, what if a history of a people... Well, so, for example, what if at the founding of the Magna Carta, we were to compare British society and their common law and what was forming, what was coming out of the Magna Carta, what if we compared that to Viking society? Would we say that, well, one society is just as good as another? Now, conservatives will stop short of saying something like a cultural relativist, because conservatives are against cultural relativism, liberals are for it, right? But if you're Oliver Wendell Holmes and you base law only, the fundamental principle is the history and the wisdom and the customs of a people. Well, what if Nazi Germany won and pulled that off for 1,000 years like Hitler wanted to, and a conservative textbook was being written in later years? We would not be comfortable from a Christian perspective with that argument. We would say that there's a real a priori justice that we can know, and we can learn much more from the wisdom of the people than from 9 sophisticates in black robes in Washington, D.C. That part the conservative is right about. But what's your corrective when it's just oppression all the way back?
One more quick question. Reading Edwards, reading Locke in the light of Edwards, is easier because of the Christian terminology that Locke uses.
Right.
But I could not. Even as a kid, before I knew Edwards, I could not reconcile Hume with my Christian faith.
Right. And Hume is saying some things, at least, that you hear Christians say today against the metaphysical speculations of back then. And I hear Christians talking like that. It's like, you know, the most famous atheist that got their ball rolling philosophically spoke like you're speaking right now. That should make you pretty uncomfortable.